This is World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. Thanks for being a World member. You make our work possible, and we appreciate your support.
Good morning. It's Thursday, July 14th, 2016, and you're listening to The World and Everything in It from World Radio. So glad to have you with us today. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Joseph Slive. Ahead today, why Republicans who want to connect with blacks and Hispanics should pay attention to how churches do it. It all begins with love. Plus, the Northeast Region finalist for World's 2016 Hope Award.
We're giving an opportunity for many different families to come together, discard false prejudice together in this context of a school.
First, Jim Henry has a summary of today's top news.
The war of words continues between Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and presumptive GOP presidential nominee Donald Trump. In a series of interviews in the past week, Ginsburg called Trump a faker and said she couldn't imagine what the country would be like if he were elected. George Washington University law professor Jonathan Turley says Ginsburg broke Supreme Court rules.
Judges cannot make speeches or statements that endorse or oppose political candidates.
And House Speaker Paul Ryan told CNN Ginsburg's objectivity is now in question.
I don't think that shows that she intends on being impartial in the future.
But Professor Turley says Trump should not have fired back in a tweet that Ginsburg's mind is shot and she should resign.
Once again, Mr. Trump takes this to a very personal level, and it's wrong.
A manhunt is underway in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, for a fourth suspect in an alleged plot to harm local police. Baton Rouge police first learned of the plot after arresting one suspect, a 17-year-old, during a burglary at a pawn shop early Saturday morning. Baton Rouge Police Chief Carl Dabadie.
We learned from that suspect that was taken into custody that the reason the burglary was being done was to harm police officers. Their goal and objective in the burglary was to get bullets. I think as his statement was to get bullets to harm police officers in the Baton Rouge area.
The information led to the arrest of two more suspects, one of them a 13-year-old. Police are urging the fourth suspect to turn himself in peacefully. Two of the eight stolen firearms remain at large. This crime occurs in the wake of the police shooting of Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge last week, which sparked massive protests across the country. British Prime Minister David Cameron said his goodbyes on Wednesday.
It has been the greatest honor of my life to serve our country as Prime Minister over these last 6 years, and to serve as leader of my party for almost 11 years.
Standing with his wife and children outside 10 Downing Street, Cameron delivered his farewell address as he prepared to tender his formal resignation at Buckingham Palace, handing the reins to his successor, Theresa May.
It's not been an easy journey, and of course we've not got every decision right. But I do believe that today our country is much stronger.
Buckingham Palace released a statement saying the Queen has accepted Cameron's resignation. May has been officially appointed Prime Minister and will proceed in selecting the members of her own cabinet. A federal court has rejected a request from a Virginia school board to prevent a so-called transgender student from using the boys' restroom. The Gloucester County School Board was seeking to delay an order that would force them to allow Gavin Grimm, who was born female, to use the bathroom of Grimm's choosing when the students returned to school in September. The court sided with Grimm, who claimed the school board's request was discriminatory. Judge Paul Niemeyer wrote the dissenting opinion, in which he said that Grimm's use of the boys' restroom violates the bodily privacy of other students. Meanwhile, police have arrested a man in Idaho for taking photos of a woman in a Target dressing room. World Radio's Christina Darnell has the story.
43-year-old Sean Patrick Smith, who says he identifies as a female and goes by Shauna Patricia Smith, allegedly reached over the changing room wall and snapped pictures of a woman trying on clothes. Smith fled the store when the victim confronted him. Authorities tracked him down, arresting him on one count of voyeurism. Smith faces up to 5 years in prison if he's convicted. In April, Target announced that people could use whatever facilities correspond with their gender identity, which has led to a boycott of the retail giant. I'm Christina Darnell.
Religious freedom legislation debated this week in a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee. Called the First Amendment Defense Act, the bill would protect people from discrimination by the federal government for their views on traditional marriage. Star witness for the legislation was former Atlanta Police Chief Calvin Cochran in this exchange with Congressman Jim Jordan.
Everyone interviewed said, no wrong conduct here at all. And still they terminated your employment because something you believed and wrote outside your responsibilities as fire chief, and you were fired for that.
Yes, sir.
The bill aims to prevent that at the federal level. Former Congressman Barney Frank opposes the bill despite acknowledging the injustice to the fire chief.
By the way, I would agree that you should not be fired for your opinion if it's not relevant to your job. Now, if you want to protect Mr. Cochran from the city of Atlanta, that's a different bill.
The bill is hailed by many as the most important religious liberty legislation in years. Both sides agreed to meet and work out other interpretations of the measure. I'm Jim Henry. Straight ahead, how love thy neighbor can work in politics as well as the church. That's next on Getting the Story. Plus, the Northwest Region finalist for World's Annual Hope Award. This is The World and everything in it.
If you have unlimited curiosity about the world, but limited time to keep up with the news and today's cultural issues, World Radio is the perfect companion, helping you integrate trustworthy news and information into your daily routine. In addition to The World and Everything in It Monday through Friday, use the World Radio app to catch Listening In each weekend as Warren Smith talks with today's thought leaders and newsmakers. Your on-the-go partner for wise insights and reliable reporting. World Radio. You'll know it when you hear it.
Next up on The World and Everything in It, how churches forge neighborhood cohesiveness and mutual support by putting love thy neighbor into practice, and what conservative politicians might learn from that. This is our bi-weekly segment called Getting the Story, highlighting a story from our sister publication, World Magazine. And this time, the story is Block by Block in the current July 23rd issue of World. Jamie Dean authored the piece, and she joins me now to discuss it. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, Mary.
Jamie, first of all, I want to ask you, what made you put conservative politics and neighborliness together in your mind for this story?
Well, I've actually been thinking about neighborliness a lot as I've been thinking about writing about politics over the last year. I mean, I think especially for conservatives who are Christians, it's key to all our relationships. I mean, you mentioned it in your introduction, love your neighbor as yourself. And of course, that's the second part of the great commandment that Jesus gave us. So I think in all our relationships, whether they're in our families or our churches or our communities, and even in politics, we should be thinking in that way. Who is my neighbor and how can I get to know them better? And so as conservative politicians have a hard time reaching out to some groups or winning the support of certain groups, particularly minority groups, I thought, I wonder how they could think about perhaps pursuing them as their neighbor. You know, in the last election, President Obama won 93% of the black vote. In the election before that, he won 96% of the black vote. So African American voters might be a place where conservatives want to think about making more inroads. And a great way to start doing that is to think of them as their neighbors and how they can simply reach out to them in some practical ways.
Well, you started out by telling the tale of Randy Green, who's an African-American man who endured a lot of hardship in his life, and then he discovered a local church. Tell us about him.
Yeah, I met him when I was in North Charleston recently, and I was on sort of an afternoon outreach effort with members of Seacoast Church, which is a large church in Charleston, and they have several campuses. One of those campuses is in an inner city area in North Charleston, and that afternoon they were just handing out some fresh vegetables and kind of meeting their neighbors. I actually know a lot of their neighbors, but just kind of touching base with them, inviting some of the kids to vacation Bible school, that sort of thing. And so we ran into Randy Green at an apartment complex, a subsidized apartment complex, and he is a member of Seacoast Church, and he was so enthusiastic and just invited us right into his apartment, and he said, "I want to show you something," and he marched me straight down the hall and showed me this picture on the wall of his baptism. He'd recently been baptized at Seacoast Church and had really come to know Christ through the members of this church, and it was interesting because this is a multi-ethnic church. There are white people, black people, Latino people, and he said, "I'd never really been to a church like that. I'd never really been to a church with a significant number of white people, and I didn't really know how that might be." And he said, but as the weeks went by and I just started seeing all of them, you know, everyone there as people, I realized they're all about the Lord. This is all about the Lord. And he really came to embrace it. And so this was a significant thing for this man. I mean, he had had, as you mentioned, a hard life, has had three heart attacks, can't work, just kind of has a lot of needs. And this church reached out to him in a very practical way. He ended up actually volunteering at the church because he liked what they were doing so much. And it's really become a good relationship. And again, that just, it became by them becoming neighbors. He is literally their neighbor. He's right down the street from the church. They reached out to him. He reached back. Mm-hmm. And it's really been a great story for him, I think.
But it wasn't just material help that Randy Green got. He also observed and experienced spiritual help. Describe what that looks like.
Well, yeah, I mean, he, you know, started going to church. I mean, as he started getting involved with a farmer's market that the church had, he decided to start attending the church on Sunday mornings and seeing what the services were all about. And his experience with having heart attacks and health problems had really humbled him, he said. And he really started to see his frailty, his mortality, started considering those things, and heard the gospel at this church and came to embrace that. And of course, that's the goal of the church, is to reach out to people materially, but also spiritually. They want to meet the deepest needs that people have. And Mr. Green certainly found that, I think, through this church.
Well, another man that you profile is a conservative politician from South Carolina who really gets down and dirty with people's lives in his district, even bagging groceries and riding around on the bus system talking to people. Tell us about that man.
And this is Senator Tim Scott, who is actually a member of Seacoast Church, where Randy Green goes to church. And that's kind of how all these things connected for me. Senator Scott is a black Republican senator. In fact, he's the first black Republican senator in the South since the era of Reconstruction. So it's really interesting. And he comes from North Charleston as well and kind of had a difficult upbringing, grew up in a single parent home. His mom worked really long hours to provide for them, but you know, he had some help along the way and a good mom, came to know the Lord himself, ended up going to college, and in time became a city council member, became a congressman, and then became a senator in the state of South Carolina. And so he very much embraces this idea of how can I be, even as a senator, a neighbor to my constituents. And so he's really kind of taken some innovative approaches to that. I mean, one thing he's done is kind of come alongside some of his constituents without saying, "Hey, I'm your senator." He's volunteered at Goodwill. One day he rode the bus all throughout Charleston without mentioning he was the senator of South Carolina. I mean, some people did recognize him, but some people didn't. And he would just have conversations with people and kind of ask them about their lives and chat with them and get to know them. As you mentioned, he's bagged groceries. He did a shift at a Moe's restaurant. And sometimes, you know, photos come out of this, but they're not really photo ops. I mean, a lot of times he just does this because he wants to actually hear what his constituents are saying. So he takes this as well, this idea of being a neighbor and finding out what they need, to a very practical level. And I think he finds that he understands the people in his district better and is able to kind of more naturally reach out to them in that way.
Mm. And Jamie, you wrote about another conservative politician, Mike Kaufman, who is a Marine Corps veteran who is white, and he also put in the sweat equity to reach a different minority group. Tell us about that.
That's right. Mike Kaufman is a congressman from Colorado, and he faced a pretty tight reelection campaign back in 2012. His district was redrawn, and it became about 20% Hispanic. And that year, he won just by 2 percentage points. So he kind of eked out a victory. So during the next election in 2014, House Democrats really saw this as one of their number one picks for seats to pick off. They targeted him and really wanted to get a Democrat in that seat. And so Mike Kaufman thought, how can I reach out to more people in my district and get to know them? And he thought specifically about Hispanics. So he did something actually very innovative and very difficult. He learned Spanish. He bought a Rosetta Stone language course. He got a tutor that he met with every week. He started reading Spanish language newspapers and magazines. I mean, he really immersed himself while he's doing all this other work to learn Spanish. And he agreed to debate his opponent on television in Spanish, I think 5 days before the election. And so I think he had the questions in advance, so he was able to prepare a little bit. But still, his willingness to kind of be vulnerable about that, to try and to learn how to speak to, again, his neighbors, his constituents. And it really, I think it made a difference. I mean, he ended up winning that race by 9 points. Instead of being defeated, he won it by 9 points, a bigger margin than what he won it in the last election. So again, just an example of someone, and he's continued to do that. I mean, he didn't drop that just because he won that election. My understanding is he's continued to learn Spanish and continue to try, and that's been successful for him.
Mm-hmm. And then there was another example of minority outreach, too, with Barbara Comstock in Virginia.
That's right. Barbara Comstock is a congressman in Virginia who reached out to Asian voters. That's been another group of voters that's been a little more difficult for Republicans to reach in recent elections. She was an aide to former Congressman Frank Wolf, who was one of our Daniel of the Year for World Magazine in recent years. And mm-hmm. he did a lot of work with Asian communities and a lot of international communities. And she got to know the communities through that and also through her work as a Virginia delegate, and just put in a lot of time going around and talking to people and getting to know them. Again, just nothing super fancy about that. Just actual real time, you know, not going a month before the election and thinking, oh, I better hit an Asian community meeting. I mean, no, she did that over time and showed genuine interest. So she actually won her election as well in a race that a lot of people saw as a real opportunity for Democrats, too.
Well, Jamie Dean's story, Block by Block, is in the current July 23rd issue of World Magazine. As a World member, you can read it in print on iPad or on the World News Group website, WNG.org. Jamie, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary.
You're busy and on the move. Time's short, but you want to stay in touch with the news that matters most. You need clarity that's instant and easy to get to. You also want to share big ideas and updates in real time with others. Stories you know will make a difference in their lives. That's what World Digital does best. Get you the story instantly and makes it easily shareable with others. World Digital, your fast lane for staying informed about the truly important news of the day on Twitter, Facebook, or WNG.org.
It's the world and everything in it from World Radio. Thanks so much for being with us. 2016 marks the 11th year of World's Hope Award for Effective Compassion, an award competition that showcases groups fighting poverty and exploitation. And they do so by providing help that meets our three Hope Award criteria. The help must be challenging, in other words, not just a handout. It must be personal rather than bureaucratic. And it must be spiritual, recognizing that material assistance, while keenly important, does not deal with the deeper needs of human life. In a moment, a profile of our Northeast Region winner this year, but first we chat with Marvin Olasky, World's Editor-in-Chief and the person who came up with the idea for the Hope Award. Now, Marvin, I said we're going to profile the Northeast winner, but you'll first have to explain that category, because this one is in Indianapolis, Indiana. Most people probably don't think of that as the Northeast, so explain that and then tell us a little bit about this regional winner, a finalist for our overall award this year.
Joseph, we're dividing the country this year by the Mississippi River, east and west.
Ah, okay.
My apologies to Midwesterners, the good Hoosiers, who are insulted to be placed in the category with those folks from Vermont. But nevertheless, that's where we are. The Oaks Academy is a classical Christian school. A lot of classical Christian schools have sprung up over the past couple of decades, many of them in suburban areas with affluent students. This one is right in inner city Indianapolis with 665 students now, and they all learn a classical Christian curriculum. They learn that God is at the center of things and that people who lived a long time ago really aren't as stupid as some moderns want to think.
Indeed, they are not. All right, well, after this piece, we'll explain how to cast your vote for our overall Hope Award winner this year. But first, here is our profile now of the Oaks Academy in Indiana, our Northeast Region winner, reported by World Radio's Kristen Eicher.
When the Oaks opened its doors in 1998, its home, a former public school building, was in a crime-ridden neighborhood in the heart of Indianapolis called Dodge City, a place of vacant lots and abandoned houses. The school's founders wanted to help families in need by going deeper than after-school tutoring and summer camp. Planting the Oaks in a tough neighborhood helped fulfill that vision. The Oaks CEO, Andrew Hart, says the school's mission was, and is, to unite the community.
We're giving an opportunity for many different families to come together, grow up together, discard false prejudice together, and build lifelong friendships in this context of a school.
The founders chose a tough curriculum that follows the classical model of education. Soon, 53 students, almost evenly divided between black and white, were memorizing the preamble to the Constitution, diagramming sentences, and working on Latin conjugations. School families appreciate the classical model because students get a time-tested, challenging curriculum rather than the latest experimental educational schemes. However, at first, parents Caesar and Sandra Bonilla didn't know what to expect with the classical education when they sent their daughter to the Oaks.
5 years ago, we don't know nothing about that. Honestly, classical education is a different education for better people. And I'm really glad for my daughter to be here for classical education.
Students develop discipline through memorization, and they learn to follow complex stories as second grade teachers read aloud The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. They read classic texts, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, John Fox's Book of Martyrs, John Milton's Paradise Lost. In a video posted to the Oaks Academy's YouTube channel, Jay Hine, president of the Indianapolis think tank the Sagamore Institute, says classical education prepares students for a thoughtful and fruitful life.
The Oaks see students as future citizens made in the image of God, full of potential. So teaching them to think, teaching them to be problem solvers, and inspiring their creativity will pay enormous dividends.
Students at the Oaks, encouraged and prompted to be all they can be, have responded to the challenge with hard work. And here's what else has happened. Over the years, the Dodge City neighborhood improved, crime decreased, and the school grew from 53 students to 665. Half are from low-income households, a fourth from middle income, and a fourth from higher income. Racially, of every 5 students, 2 are African American, 2 are white, and 1 is biracial, Asian, or Hispanic. There's one other important thing about the school's curriculum. It reflects a biblical worldview, but in a purposely understated way.
If you walk into the Oaks, you wouldn't necessarily say, oh, this is a Christian school. We're not affiliated with a particular church. We don't see it as dogmatic, nor do we see it as denominational. We can just rest in the trust that God's Spirit is here and is very active and present.
When the Oaks began, Indiana was in the midst of moving from a limited set of public and private schooling options to a dizzying array of choices. Public schools with cross-district enrollment choice, private schools with vouchers for low-income families, and charter schools with some additional online options. The Oaks has benefited from those options. More than half of the students use vouchers, but the school also has a significant donor base, which allows a $2 million scholarship program, giving at least 85% of the students some kind of scholarship assistance. Single parent Michael Hall is one of those who's benefited from the school's generous financial assistance.
They open the doors to other individuals that aren't economically challenged. But when you speak of me and my family, I have to stop and think of the fact that I really wouldn't be here with three children as a single parent without the Oaks extending an opportunity for me.
Like every other school, the Oaks is not without its challenges. Perhaps the biggest obstacle now is its success and the temptation to drift from the school's original goal of helping those in need. One way the Oaks has responded is by opening multiple new locations in other low-income areas. The Oaks Brookside, located on the east side of the city, and the Oaks Middle School, not far from the Oaks Academy's first location. And the students there are thriving. Last year, the Oaks led the state on the Indiana Academic Test, beating out better-endowed private schools and suburban schools. In a video posted online, parent Valerie Davis says the Oaks helped her daughter see her own potential.
I owe the Oaks everything because I think my daughter could have been a statistic because of where we lived or the neighborhood or community, but they showed her other options. Now she wants to be a doctor. She knows it's possible. And I think it started here. I think it gave her, hey, I can do anything.
In case you're wondering where the name of the school comes from, you'll find the answer in Isaiah chapter 61, verses 3 and 4, which reads, "They will be called the Oaks of Righteousness, a planting of the Lord for the display of his splendor. They will rebuild the ancient ruins and restore the places long devastated. They will renew the ruined cities that have been devastated for generations." Reporting for World Radio about the Oaks Academy, Indianapolis, Indiana, I'm Kristen Eicher.
So far on World Radio, we've profiled our Hope Award winners for the Southeast and the Northeast. Still to come, the Southwest and Northwest, plus our international winner. From among those five, we want you to vote for the one you think should be the overall winner of World's 2016 Hope Award for Effective Compassion. You can learn more about the five finalists and the voting process online at wmg.org/compassion.
Every day, we're bombarded with information ranging from misleading to meaningless. But World's Reliable Reporting brings clarity to the news, helping your family make sense of the madness. We can't stop the barrage of messages targeted at our families, but we can help you be the strongest voice in the room with our new family membership, equipping your entire family with truth and biblical perspective. Redeem your family membership today at wng.org/family.
Thanks for listening to The World and Everything in It from World Radio. As moving vans pull up in front of 10 Downing Street, Britain's version of the White House, a new leader prepares to take the UK into a new era, post-European Union. And commentator Cal Thomas says she might remind you a bit of another former British prime minister.
Is Britain's new prime minister, Theresa May, the next Margaret Thatcher? There are similarities. May is certainly as tough as the Iron Lady. As Home Secretary for longer than any of her predecessors, she strongly opposed uncontrolled immigration. The Home Office introduced visa restrictions that required non-European Union immigrants living in Britain for fewer than 10 years to minimally earn the equivalent of $47,000 so as not to be a drain on social welfare programs. With Britain's planned exit from the EU, that policy could be broadened to include all immigrants. In a speech to her Conservative Party last year and in more recent remarks, May has struck a chord with British citizens who feel they're losing their country and its unique characteristics to foreigners who refuse to assimilate. She told fellow party members, quote, When immigration is too high, when the pace of change is too fast, it's impossible to build a cohesive society, unquote. And while announcing her candidacy for prime minister last month, she added,
there are millions of people in poorer countries who would love to live in Britain. And there is a limit to the amount of immigration any country can and should take.
This has driven the left nuts. They've accused her of everything except being a lady. It seems the last thing the British and American left want is a cohesive society, because such a society would not allow them to pit groups against each other, dividing and conquering at the ballot box. Here's something else that should appeal to average British citizens, at least the older ones, who are mostly more reserved than Americans and younger Brits.
Public service has been a part of who I am for as long as I can remember. And I know I'm not a showy politician. I don't tour the television studios. I don't gossip about people over lunch. I don't go drinking in Parliament's bars. I don't often wear my heart on my sleeve. I just get on with the job in front of me.
That two women competed to replace David Cameron ought to have delighted feminists. Not so. For the left, it isn't really about electing more women to political office. It's about electing more liberals, some of whom can be women. History doesn't always repeat, but the political stars seem to be aligning over London and Washington for a possible sequel to what happened with Thatcher's election win in 1979. Ronald Reagan's victory followed a year later. While May is ideologically much closer to Thatcher than Trump is to Reagan, Trump has picked up on a theme that worked for both Reagan and Nixon. Following the Dallas ambush and the protests that have exploded in major cities, Trump has styled himself as the law and order candidate. That this is occurring in an election year should be no surprise. But just as riots in the streets contributed to Republican victories in 1968, the political fallout this year might repeat. In a recent speech in Virginia Beach, Virginia, Trump said,
"We must maintain law and order at the highest level, or we will cease to have a country." 100%, we will cease to have a country. I am the law and order candidate.
Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, he said, is weak, ineffective, pandering, and as proven by her recent email scandal, that she's either a liar or grossly incompetent. Britain and the U.S. are experiencing social and political turmoil. Both nations are perceived by many to have weak leaders. Trump and May display strength, and in troubled times, British and American voters have demonstrated they prefer strength to weakness. For World Radio, I'm Cal Thomas.
Columnist and commentator Cal Thomas is the author of What Works: Common Sense Solutions for a Stronger America.
That is our program for this Thursday, the 14th of July. The World and Everything in It is a production of member-supported World Radio, part of World, a nonprofit news team committed to honest reporting from a biblical worldview perspective.
Be sure to tell your friends and family about World and about our three-month trial membership. Just tell them to go to getworldnow.com. Getworldnow.com. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Joseph Slife. On tomorrow's program, John Stone Street with our weekly conversation on the culture, plus a quick explanation of the international Pokemon Go craze. We hope you can join us for The World and Everything in It.